Food has always been political. Who has access to it? Who profits from it? And in this case, who's cooking it? With the Me Too movement, male chefs have been making headlines for their abhorrent behavior. But why are women chefs not making the news at all, even when they're cooking brilliant and dynamic food? In Megan McCarron's article, The Chefs We Don't See, for Eater, she explores the obstacles that women chefs face. Ms. McCarron is joined by two phenomenal women chefs. We've got Allison Plummer, co-owner and the chef at Lot 2 in Brooklyn, and Anita Lowe, who was voted one of the 10 best chefs in America by Food & Wine magazine and was the chef and owner of the beloved restaurant Anissa that's since closed. Allison, Anita, Megan, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So, Megan, you wrote about the invisibility of women chefs. What do you mean by that?
What I mean is women chefs have been here and affecting American food and really, you know, setting the tone in American food for a really long time. And yet the story we keep telling tends to center on men. And the, you know, when we tell a story about the revolutions of American food, we tend to think of people, you know, like Grant Achatz or like Mario Batali or, you know, even Wolfgang Puck. And we leave out women who have just been shaping that as much, you know, people like Judy Rogers, people like Alice Waters, who's in the press, but we don't talk about her as a chef in the same way, or people like Anita, who've done a great deal to shape how we cook in America today. And what I wanted to explore is, why is that happening? Why are all the big reviews, big profiles, so much more about men than they are about women in American media?
Well, one thing is true is that there are far fewer women in the kitchen than men, especially when it comes to being the head chef. You know, you'll see women as line cooks, you'll see women in the garde manger, as pastry chefs, but as they rise to the ranks, few of them get to reach head chefs. So what are the factors that are excluding women from this role? I mean, Anita and Allison, you guys have come up through the ranks. What have you been seeing, or what have you seen?
I've seen a lot of strong women standing behind strong men.
Mm-hmm. So how so?
You know, as long as we portray this bad boy mentality, I think it's always going to be the man who's running the restaurant who's going to be within the spotlight. Running a kitchen is a lot like driving a ship. I think that everybody who's there plays an important part. And we so often look at this mean-spirited captain as opposed to the deckmates behind them, the strong women who are kind of leading the movement within these kitchens, but not portraying this restaurant mentality that we see portrayed in the media.
So they're doing as much work, but they're just not, so they're just not getting the spotlight is what you're saying.
Yes.
And what about Anita, what about you? What have you seen?
I think we've got a societal issue here. I think it's a cultural issue. I think in general, people are socialized not to put women in charge and not to even see women in charge. And I think that is something that we, you know, that some women not, I mean, I think we can, it's unavoidable that we are we can think of ourselves that way. It's a myth that we need to overcome. It's, you know, in the media, we're just constantly seeing our roles as behind men,
as support,
as, you know, we're cleaning, we're doing the we're doing the caretaking. Yeah, and when I've seen a lot of women get out to be caretakers. They've had children, and I think that's changing, but you know, in the '90s, we lost a lot of like great chefs to families.
Megan, in your article, you wrote about there was this moment of the woman chef in the 1980s, and I think Anita, that's what you're sort of referring to, where women chefs were on the rise, and then something happened. What happened?
Well, it's really interesting. The person who I actually spoke to about this was Ruth Reichel, who was, you know, writing all these pieces in the LA Times and before that in the New Times about how the time of the woman chef was coming. There are a ton of women doing great cooking, especially in California. People like Evan Kleiman, Mary Sue Milliken and Susan Feiniger, Judy Rogers and Alice Waters, like I just mentioned, and a lot of women who we've now forgotten. She mentioned a woman named Wendy Little. And what Ruth says she saw happen was two things. One of them definitely was the lack of support for women to both work and have a family, like Anita just said. But Ruth Reichl's theory also was she didn't see women getting those kind of deep-pocketed investors who helped to, you know, really make the careers and ensure the career longevity of male chefs who are rising in that same era. So, you know, even if a man were to have a family or, you know, one restaurant would flounder, there would be resources to keep taking risks, to keep growing, to try a new thing, you know, to go into frozen food or all this, you know, sort of interesting things that happened in the 90s in American food. But women didn't have those investors and they didn't have that, you know, support. And that in Ruth Reichl's mind was what caused them to have to, you know, drop out or change careers or move into consulting or a lot of other things that we saw happen.
Okay, I want to get back to the idea of investors in a minute because I want to talk about, you know, running your own businesses because both of you obviously have owned your owners of your business or and of your Anissa. But I want to just talk about the way that kitchens are kind of the way that women don't have support when they want to have a family, and it's assumed that they're going to be the caretakers somehow, that it's not assumed that, well, they'll have a husband at home to take care of it, and there's no flexibility. Because what I've noticed as a journalist is that a lot of women become pastry chefs because the hours are earlier and that it's somehow more flexible. Have you seen that? Is that part of it? Is it sort of this assumption of women being the caretaker, the primary caretaker of a family?
I've seen that, and among, I mean, I don't have children, but you know, and I'm gay, but it's I've seen that from employees as well. So,
I think you often see strong women who play important roles within the kitchen. They take a step out to have a child, and it's really hard to kind of maintain that spot for you while you perhaps leave for maternity leave. There's always somebody behind you who's eyeing for that position. I think it's part of the industry. It's less hospitable in terms of parental leave. There's always somebody gunning for your spot in this world of competition. I think it's hard to facilitate the idea of maintaining a family and also maintaining a business.
If you've just joined us, we're speaking with Allison Plummer, Anita Lowe, and Megan McCarron about women chefs in the wake of the Me Too movement. So let's get back to investors. Let's get back to, you know, opening your own restaurant and having people support you. Both of you have done that. How hard was it for you to get investors in your restaurant? And was it harder because you were women? Is that, in fact, true, what Megan was saying?
I mean, Anissa was family-funded. It was funded by all of my savings, plus my mother was the investor, and my partner Jen also put in some money. So we didn't actually get investors.
Right, so you didn't have, if you went that route, do you think you could have? Why did you, I mean, or did you know, what made you go that route?
What made me go that route?
Rather than looking for, you know, the big bucks.
I wanted to have a complete creative control and
independence
was more that, and I didn't, you know, honestly, I didn't have, you know, there weren't people throwing money at me, so there was one person that wanted to invest that I remember, and I didn't end up reaching out because we had enough, but I have been lucky. But again, I don't think I'm not getting thrown a million, you know, expensive deals like some of my peers.
Right.
Male peers.
Yeah. Allison, what about you?
You know, Lot 2 is independently owned and operated, and we are 9 years old now. We are certainly not attracting any investors. In running a solid neighborhood restaurant, that's not a term that investors are running to. And having very little exposure, it's hard to kind of maintain the day-to-day business is hard enough, let alone trying to expand or put yourself out there in a way that is attractive to people with money. But I think at the same time, we're so proud to be independently owned and operated. To kind of maintain our own integrity each day is so much more important to us than having to adhere by somebody else's creative standards or rules.
Do you think that women are afraid of taking money just because of perception in the food world that it's going to be riskier for them and that somehow they'll have to, you know, live up to this bigger ideal or different ideal than for men? It's like, okay, they take the money and if they lose it or something, like there's not as much expectation necessarily. Women feel the burden. I guess what I'm saying is, do women feel the burden of taking money more? So maybe want to What do you think?
That's interesting. I think it has to do with responsibility. With great power comes great responsibility. I think men perhaps have a little bit more bravado. They're more willing to throw things around in terms of creativity and their vision. And I do. I think in being a female running a successful business, there's a lot of responsibility that comes with that. And you feel the pressure of that every day, just maintaining business. But to then have to look out for somebody else's money, I do. I think that comes with a lot of pressure.
Yeah, I certainly felt that. I'm not quite sure. I don't know, how men feel, honestly.
Right. But you felt that you wanted to stay.
Well, no. I mean, lost a lot of money at Barque. I had a 120-seat restaurant in the village for a couple of years. And, I made some mistakes, I think. But we also opened just before the stock market crash. Mm. And I felt horrible,
Right. And was that investor money?
Yeah, it was investor. It was purely investor money. They were fine. They were, the most lovely people in the whole world, and they totally got it. And, I think they had enough money that it didn't matter that much. But, it was devastating.
Do you think that there's some scar tissue left there for going forward in your career?
Probably. But that being said, I think there's more scar tissue from other things.
Right. Yeah. Do you think that sexism played into the closing of Anissa at all?
That's a really interesting question that I don't know that I can answer. I came to that decision for many complex reasons, and. Could I have gotten more attention from the media?
But it was an incredibly successful restaurant. People loved it.
People did love it, yeah. But, as we were speaking earlier, I think there were a lot of things that women get overlooked for that our male counterparts get all the credit for. I mean, there were things that were, and I'm not going to blame the media. There were many, and again, I take full responsibility for closing that restaurant. In the media, it's true that women aren't getting the visibility. I think there were things that we did, a decade ago. That some guy was getting attention for, in the New York Times, or why are they sending someone to? Why is the New York Times sending someone to photograph Tom Colicchio's restaurant? Does he need more? Does he need more visibility?
Yeah, you're talking about a recent article that came out, right?
Yeah, and the Times have been called out for that. I think and I get it. We're all socialized to look at the men, but. The question has been raised, and I know that all the people, I'm sorry, I know you work there.
No, that's fine.
Yeah. I know all the people have been called out on this.
Yeah.
And yet it's still happening. So, yeah.
So, Megan, actually, you could talk, this is basically forms the basis of your whole article, that the media does have a cultural bias. So you want to talk about what you found and how we can shift the paradigm?
Of course, yeah. So I think why I felt like I needed to write this article was there's a book that came out in 2015 called Taking the Heat by two sociologists, Deborah Harris and Patty Guffrey, who are at Texas State. And I found out about this book really early because I was editing Eater Austin, and they reached out to me as just like someone from Eater nearby to tell me about this book. And it's an incredible book. I think if you work in food media, you absolutely need to read this book. And even if you just, are a woman who's cooking, you also might see a lot of your experience reflected in here. But the book covers a lot. They followed 30 women in the restaurant industry in Central Texas. But the piece I'm writing about here is they did this really wide-ranging survey of food media, and specifically high-profile food media. Because I think what we don't want to get lost is what I'm talking about, and I think what we talk about when we talk about media bias is not, just oh, what gets covered opening and closing, or what gets one review, but what's the stuff that gets the profile? What's the stuff that gets the 3- and 4-star review? What's the stuff that gets revisited by a critic 5 years later?
And is that what you mean when you say high-profile food media?
Yeah, yeah. It's like reviews, like full restaurant reviews and also profiles. And what they did is they looked at 2,026 reviews and profiles from 4 publications, Food & Wine, Gourmet, The New York Times, and The San Francisco Chronicle from, I think, 2004 to 2009. So this is a little ways back. They found that 1,727 of those pieces were solely about male chefs, which is just sort of an insane number to think about. And what they also did, besides sort of doing those counts, which we were sort of familiar with, is they coded, how are the men described and how are the women described? And I think that sort of helps to fill in, why are we sending more critics, to men's restaurants than women's restaurants? At Eater, Amanda Clute, our editor-in-chief, did sort of an audit, and we found that our critics were still only going to 30% of their restaurants owned by women, was 30% of their reviews. And we've made a commitment to, addressing that. So it's just sort of a thing that happens in food media. And what they found, what these two sociologists found, was over and over again, when men do get these high-profile coverage, they're labeled as these risk-taking, boundary-busting geniuses, these perfectionists who torture themselves, incredible entrepreneurs, real creative, artistic geniuses. And then women, when they do get these high-profile kind of coverage, they are portrayed as nurturing, guardians of tradition, unassuming, really humble, just trying to run their one restaurant and make everyone happy, And that, I think, is a really important finding. And I use this a lot as an editor. When I was an editor, I worked with our critics. I worked on long form. So I was on that kind of coverage. And, as an editor, I would see it. And in my own work, I would see myself wanting to move in that direction. Because, there's nothing inherently wrong with having a nurturing environment or, moving food tradition forward. But when you see that that's what women are stuck in, and these men have these much more dynamic stories being told about them, of course you're going to keep sending reporters and photographers to cover the men because they have the exciting stories. But maybe we are the sort of seeing the exciting stories in men and not in women. Like Anita was saying, she would do something really innovative, but then she would see a male chef get credit for doing the same thing. And so I think what I don't want to get lost here is, I don't think this is unique in the media, and I don't think, just counting is necessarily the way to think about it. But I do think as food journalists, and then more broadly as people who love food or people who might invest in restaurants, all sorts of people need to kind of think about, here are the two stories we've been handed, and these stories are serving men really well, getting them on TV, getting them big deals, keeping their restaurants alive, keeping reporters going to talk to them. And the stories we've been handed about women that sometimes we are also responsible for perpetuating are sort of shamefully boring. And women chefs are the least boring people on the planet. They have incredible stories to tell, and they're incredibly talented. And it's a real shame that as American culture has embraced food and embraced restaurant culture, as the story that we're really interested in, women are not being seen in that story.
So now what about women food critics and women food writers? And you and I, Megan, we're part of this. What role are we playing in creating this narrative of female chefs?
I think it's really complicated for women like you and I, Melissa. I will say women reporters and food writers are often out front on trying to correct some of this narrative. There's a reason I talked to Ruth Reichel for this. And, she did a ton of important work both here in California and at the New York Times. When we see now a lot of the Me Too reporting, there are some men food writers who are doing that reporting, but a lot of it is women. And I think that that is important. But in this survey that these sociologists did, which I think is why it's such a useful thing to go back to, they had work that they cited with women's bylines on it. And I do think You know, I was recently writing up a blurb, just a short blurb about Jessica Coslow, who's the chef at Squirrel here in Los Angeles, you know, really important restaurant to LA dining culture and national dining culture. But when I sat down, you know, this was after writing this article, this was after reading this book and working with it for years, when I sat down to write, like, Jessica Coslow is one of the most important chefs in America and changed the way we eat forever, that felt unnatural to write.
You know,
and
yeah, no, I do the same thing, and I hear you. We're going to get right back into this after the break, because this is fascinating. But I'm Melissa Clark, and I'm speaking with Megan McCarron and chefs Allison Plummer and Anita Lowe. And we're talking about Megan's piece for Eater entitled "The Chefs We Don't See." And we're back. We're talking to journalist Megan McCarron of Eater, who wrote an article about why women chefs have not had the visibility of their male counterparts. And we are also talking to Chef Anita Lowe and Chef Allison Plummer in our station right now. And we're talking about the stereotypes that surround women chefs versus male chefs. And one thing that we mentioned before, which I want to get back to, is the idea of women chefs guarding authenticity and almost being more reflective of a home cook. You know, their grandmothers and mothers, and they're keeping this, the food that has always been cooked and guarding it. And male chefs are breaking molds, and they're creating something new. And Megan, so that was something that we were just talking about. How do we break out of that? How do we start telling different stories? Why, and also, why is it so unnatural for you to say, we were just talking about Jessica Coslow, why is it so unnatural for you to say, this woman chef is so important, is one of the most important chefs, or the most important chefs in LA food culture right now? It's a lot to answer. You choose which one.
Yeah.
We'll go from there. We'll get back to the other. These are so many things we have to talk about.
Right, I know. I'm so excited to be talking about it. So, I really struggled with this writing this piece, because what I sort of landed on is we have sort of a two-pronged culture. I mean, two-pronged problem in our culture. And this is generally true. You know, this is how we talk about women artists and entrepreneurs of all kinds of disciplines. So I also think that there is a bigger cultural problem, but I also don't think that's a dodge for, you know, taking responsibility in the world that we're lucky enough to be in. The food world is so exciting right now. And I think the two-pronged problem is our culture values sort of male-coded behaviors, right? You know, if something is considered masculine, it's considered good. Our culture values aggressiveness. It values, maybe taking a risk that doesn't even necessarily pan out, or like it values, sort of a relentless perfectionism, maybe at the expense of other people. But then also these values are only assigned to men. So I think food media sometimes gets caught in a trap where a lot of us journalists are actually tired of going to restaurants where, you know, we know the person is a shouter, there's sort of a reputation that this person is like an aggressive person who's hard on his staff. The food isn't always welcoming, you know, maybe the flavors are aggressive but not satisfying. And so then as a corrective, journalists want to write about women chefs as doing something different. You know, oh, but they're so nurturing to their staff. Oh, but their food is just so delicious. You know, it's not taking too many risks. You know, like wanting to value a different kind of values than what the restaurant world has sort of stereotypically nurtured. But the problem with that is it's ignoring women who are chefs. It's ignoring women who are being creative. And like I saw this really clearly. There's a piece in the San Francisco Chronicle about, you know, three restaurants that had lasted 30 years without being too gratuitously creative. And one of them is Zuni Cafe, where Judy Rogers, you know, introduced to American dining culture one of the most impactful dishes, which is this chicken for two. If you live in a major city in America, you've probably ordered a chicken for two that comes with some lovely sides, but that started there. But instead of saying, wow, you know, this is a real revolution in how we think about cooking and food in America, and now it's everywhere, what a brilliant chef, it's like, wow, Judy Rogers just wanted to please everyone. Thank God she didn't try too hard to, like, change things.
Ah.
So that's the kind of, you know, that's the kind of thing that can make you crazy, I think, especially as a woman who is cooking and who is a chef and who is, you know, throwing her whole heart and soul into her work, wants to push cuisine forward, trained in the same kitchens, or didn't and came in sideways and wants to do something really unique. And I think, you know, it comes down to the word genius. You know, now that our culture has moved from, you know, wanting not to see the people in the back of the kitchen and wanting to talk about the maitre d', you know, which is how things were in the 50s and 60s, to wanting to see the people making this food and wanting to call them geniuses, there's still this extreme hesitation to see women as geniuses. And that's not unique to food, but I think of all things where the delicious food we eat is the product of the genius of our grandmothers, great-grandmothers, great-great-grandmothers, great-great-great-great-grandmothers, you know, the women who we can find only through our mitochondria have taught humanity how to eat well. To refuse to see genius in women cooking in restaurants is fairly insane.
Okay, Allison, you look like you have something to say about the idea of genius.
I do, and I'm so intrigued by this, just in terms of talking about the media. You know, the media is what so many of us have to go by, and I think now it's the responsibility of the media to kind of train people what we think of as genius in this industry. The media has taught us what we think of as success in this industry, this bad boy image. We need to redefine what we think of as greatness. Why is maintaining a restaurant based on tradition no longer groundbreaking or noteworthy? Why is that not worthy of being great? And so I'm curious to see what the media is going to do now in terms of building up the female chef and kind of playing back all of these bad boys and these Tom Colicchios. It's the media's turn now, I think, to kind of highlight these underseen female chefs and kind of bring them to light.
And what did you think of the term gratuitous creativity?
Gratuitous creativity.
Gratuitous, that stuck with me. Megan, what about you? So you were writing about that in your piece. So
yeah,
the male chefs are genius and female chefs are gratuitously creative.
Right, or not gratuitously creative. And I agree with Allison. You know, what I concluded in my piece was, yeah, we need to sort of break out of this binary and that, yeah, this new idea of genius needs to emerge. And this is a conversation that's been happening sort of more quietly in the restaurant world for a long time. And Me Too has galvanized a lot of the most essential aspects of it. You know, I do think there's sort of an overvaluing of, you know, making something different for the sake of making it different, because that was obviously creative. It didn't take too much knowledge of food in a way to understand that, like, a spherical soup was creative in a way that maybe a soup in a bowl was less creative, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I still prefer soup in the bowl. But so, you know, I think that it's this, I think we do need to see creativity in a different way, and we need to see that, you know, our food traditions from around the world, which we're so lucky to sort of be able to experience in major American cities, have value in and of themselves and are creative in and of themselves. That said, I do think women chefs are creative in a lot of ways that are also being overlooked and also are maybe penalized if their creativity doesn't succeed wildly in a way that you know, male chefs are not. It's considered whimsy instead of, you know, a bold risk.
So we just have a couple of minutes left, and I just want to, Megan, I just wanted to ask you one question. You know, a lot of people all over the country, but in New York especially, we're thinking about the Spotted Pig and what's going to happen. I know you just interviewed Ashley Merriman, who's Gabrielle's partner. Can you just talk about that a little bit?
Sure. So quick recap. The Spotted Pig was the subject of a really groundbreaking Me Too investigation by the New York Times, by Kim Severson and Julia Moskin, which found, you know, rampant alleged misconduct on the part of the co-owner, Ken Friedman. Also some allegations, you know, that maybe some of this had been overlooked by the chef who was there, April Bloomfield. April and Ken have now severed their business partnership, and coming in to take over the Spotted Pig is a really well-known chef couple, Gabrielle Hamilton and Ashley Merriman. And, you know, I'm not sure where to keep filling in. But
did Ashley say anything that I know she'd said before that it wasn't her job to clean up Ken's mess?
Yes. And, you know, I don't want to say what someone should or shouldn't do with their career. And I do think there is an argument for saying, you know, I think in general, food media is maybe asking women chefs to do too much work of making the restaurant industry seem okay again, or sort of arguing that, like, oh, if we just put women in charge, this will all be fixed. So I do think that that is a good point. I think the argument of not coming in to clean up a mess, when we know that a restaurant's culture flows from the top down, and also Ken Friedman is still, as far as we know, a co-owner of the Spotted Pig, you know, raises a lot of questions of, you know, why do you want to get into that culture? You know, if it's not your job to clean up the mess, why walk into somewhere where there was so much harassment of employees? And I think what I don't want to get lost in a lot of this is, it's not just abhorrent behavior. It's not just a mess. This is systematized harassment of women at work, women trying to, in many ways in the restaurant industry, live their dreams, be a part of one of the most exciting parts of American culture. And I think when we boil it down to something that's like a sex issue or a social issue instead of an economic and work issue, that's where lines get muddy that I don't think is appropriate.
Megan, thank you so much for joining me. Anita and Allison, it's been great talking to you. There's much more conversation that needs to be had about this topic. I hope to do it again soon. But thank you for joining me. I'm Melissa Clark, and I've been speaking with chefs Allison Plummer, Anita Lowe, and journalist Megan McCarron about her recent piece for Eater entitled The Chefs We Don't See.